I'd like now to welcome back to the program Craig Johnson and Armando Espinosa Prieto. They are founders of the Metamorphosis Documentation Project. Their new film is Todos Santos, La Fiesta de las Almas, The Feast of the Souls. And there is a talk and a screening at the Museum of International Folk Art today, Wednesday, the 16th of January at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So you are doing a comparison of Day of the Dead ceremonies in different places in Latin America?
Yes, we're right now involved in a 5 or 6 year project of doing specific individual projects of Day of the Dead in different parts of Latin America and also here in New Mexico, where we'll do an individual project on that ethnicity, that community, 1 year, and repeat or do the same type of projects over that time frame. And then at the end of that time, we'll use all the material that we've compiled to put together a feature-length documentary that will compare those different traditions in the different communities and different ethnicities.
And I'm sure there are already emerging some parallels as well as some differences.
Yes, actually quite a few. Some people say that when you compare anything you compare, it's easier to find the differences than the similarities, and the differences are more important than the similarities. And in this case, most of the differences come from the specific view of the world of the different ethnicities. The similarities come from the Catholic influence into these cultures.
So the Todos Santos ceremony, the Day of the Dead ceremony that you filmed in this, and the whole preparations and people talking about it, was in Candelaria in Chuquisaca, Bolivia, which is an Andean part of Bolivia. And it is, well, what is this place like? I mean, how remote is it? How much contact do they have with the non-Quechua speaking outside world?
Well, now, first of all, they only got electricity like 3-4 years ago. Now the road that goes by the town, it has a lot more traffic than it used to, so there is a little more contact. But it's like 45 minutes away from the closest center, and that is like an hour and or so away from Sucre. People that are familiar with that area know of Tarabuco. That culture usually called Tarabuco culture because that's where the big market is. But the culture really is Yampará, and they are part of the Yampará culture. And the people from Candelaria are very well known for being some of the best weavers of that area.
And we see some of the weaving in this documentary.
Yeah. Yes.
And they have a local weaving association of mostly women weavers who have been here to Santa Fe for the International Folk Art Market that we've been working with them for several years, and they've come up 3 times to the Folk Art Market. But the community actually is very isolated and small. The main village is only about 400 people, and they are agrarian along with their weaving as far as...
And so how did you decide that this was a place you were going to do this particular documentary?
Well, the first time we went to Bolivia, because we were very interested in textiles, we were trying to visit as many of the well-known textile areas, and we wound up in Sucre, and there we hired a driver that spoke Quechua, and we went to a few of the communities known for weaving in that area, and this was one of the communities, and we met this woman. And it's a sort of an interesting story because I'm Cuban, and we get to the house, we're seated, we start talking, she starts showing her weavings because obviously we had interest in buying, and then she asked us where we were from, and I said I was Cuban. And all of a sudden, she started hugging me and kissing me and almost throwing me up in the air. And I couldn't understand why. And so I find out that her son, 6 months before, had gone to Cuba to study medicine. on a scholarship from the Cuban, Venezuelan, and Bolivian government. So we created this instant bond.
Amazing.
And that's how we started visiting her, and then we helped the association come for Folkart Market, and then we already had a connection. I started inquiring about Todos Santos Day of the Dead celebrations there, and one thing led to the other, and you know.
Now their language is Quechua, which is an Inca language spoken by several million people, and they also, when you're watching it, I love this because there's a bunch of Spanish thrown in to the point where if you speak Spanish, you kind of think you're understanding them, but you're really not because it's mostly Quechua, but it's a kind of like it's like a Spanglish hybrid. And I was wondering whether the ceremonies were also kind of like that, like some of the Catholicism, but really a lot of the Quechua rituals.
Well, it is in a way. In other areas of Bolivia, it's much more clear that different influences. This place was grew around a colonial hacienda, and the hacienda controlled the life of these people. And there was no specific church, so there is a lot of pagan culture and beliefs involved, because the chapel of the church was the spiritual base of the community. They considered themselves very Catholic, but from my experience, it's not, you know, the same Catholic that would be somebody from Italy or from Spain.
I think their Catholicism is more a belief in the blessings that they have from the different rituals that the church offers, rather than really following the dogma and the practice of the religion.
Right. So what is the... I mean, people should go see the film, and it's today at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but just to give us a sense, what is this Todos Santos, All Souls, Day of the Dead, or All Saints, Day of the Dead like? It goes over several days...
Well, in this, we are very familiar with the Mexican celebrations of Day of the Dead that take it go on for 2 days. There in Bolivia is different because it's an isolated place, and the celebration is only done for 2 years. People don't make altars every year to their dead. They do offerings to their dead souls in the storage house where they keep their crops, and they do go to the cemetery. They do not build altars. They build altars two years.
So if somebody dies, it's the first year and the second year.
And that's it. And there is a big feast. The first time is a huge feast where it can last a week, it can last a week and a half, depending on how many family members come from all over. Some walk for days to get to the fiesta, and then it depends on how much chicha they made. Chicha is like a beer, and once they make the chicha, it has to be consumed.
Right.
So if there is chicha to party for a week and a half, they party for a week and a half.
And there's a little bit about the making of the chicha in the film, and it's made of corn.
Corn, and in this place they use some
wheat. Also.
Yeah.
But you know, what most people don't realize is the importance of the preparations of the celebrations. Because the way I see it, when all these people come together to celebrate their ancestors, their dead, they're creating community. They feel like they belong. You know, there is the belief that if you don't honor the dead, bad things will happen to you. And the truth is that if you honor them, you create community, you belong, and you feel good.
Right.
And there's specifically with the teacher, it reflects that. There's in this community and in general, I think there was. In this case, an elderly woman who was in charge, and she knew what was supposed to be done, and even though she didn't do all the work, she watched over and made sure everything was done correctly so that chicha would come out right. And chicha is considered a sacred drink that is shared and if you have it sort of almost a communion, so that it is a very important part of the celebration from beginning to end.
Right. And people, as you say, come from all over the place, and it, for many people, as we saw in the film, it's a place where they meet maybe cousins and other relatives that they didn't really even know they had.
Well, that was one of the things that I thought was so interesting, and it was that it is where they meet their family. You know, little kids only in these moments or in this feast get to meet their uncles and their cousins that they never see because they live 4 walking days away. And that's another important way in which these fiestas contribute to creating community, because they do not only they meet their own family, but they meet the neighbor's family, and because it's a big shared fiesta.
We're talking about the film Todos Santos, La Fiesta de las Almas, the Feast of the Souls. Now, what was it like for them to be filmed? I mean, these are people who've had electricity for a couple of years, so they're not exactly involved in media culture.
Well, you know, the truth is that a lot of the young people, because a lot of the young people are studying in the city, and they have cell phones, and they shoot their movies, cell phone movies, and you know, there's you know, electricity arrived, and with electricity arrived CD players and DVD players, and they all watch films and they love it.
But it also, it was one thing that happened when we, because we take these projects back, and in this case we took it back to the community with the movie was done, and in the Weavers Association that has a small museum there, we set up a little permanent exhibit to Todos Santos and gifted them with a flat screen TV and a DVD player so they could show it and they can sell the movie to benefit the museum. And we did a public event where in a large auditorium in the local school, we set up a projector and it did a large screen or large format presentation of the movie for the whole community. And they loved it. And they loved seeing themselves. There were different places in the movie where, you know, one particular person will be a little bit comical and the whole place would erupt.
Right.
And by the time the movie was over, we immediately had to show it again. And it was the same type of reaction the second time through.
Nice.
The only complaint at the end was that it was too short.
And it's a half an hour long, so it's quite a compact documentary, which is very nice. And as you said, you're going to be putting them all together, probably re-editing in a lot of ways.
Oh.
Which you'll have to do by the time this is all done. But one of the things that's noteworthy about this project, the Metamorphosis Documentation Project, is that every community that you go to, you are, first of all, giving them the rights to the film, and you're really helping them set up cultural preservation mechanisms.
Well, we try. We always say that our mission is to protect, promote, and preserve traditional cultures. I think change is going to happen anyhow. I mean, the modern world is really going fast, and the only way of preserving these traditions is for that change to happen on their own terms. If it's forced onto them, or if they do not understand what they have or what's coming for them, it's going to be more destructive than if they are aware of it all.
Craig Johnson and Armando Espinosa Prieto are founders of the Metamorphosis Documentation Project. Their new film is called Todos Santos, La Fiesta de las Almas, The Feast of the Souls, and they will be giving a talk and screening the film today at the Museum of International Folk Art at 2 in the afternoon. It's great to have you back on the show and look forward to seeing you today and next year when the next one comes out.
Thank you very much, Marichelle.
Thank you, Marichelle.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Morris Ruiz. He is the lead actor, the only actor in the one-man play Just a Gigolo by Stephen Lowe, and Vanessa Rawlings Jackson, who is the producer of this play, which is being performed on Saturday, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and 2 o'clock on Sunday at the Santa Fe Playhouse. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you.
So the person whom you are playing, Morris, is a kind of actor in the great drama of the extended D.H. Lawrence saga. His name is Angelo or Angelino Ravagli. Who was this person?
He was a Capitano de Bersaglieri of the Italian army, Mussolini's special forces, and they never said anything. They call themselves the men with feathers in their hat, and wives are not supposed to speak. It's all sort of hush-hush and secret. Why, I don't know. And anyway, he was the he's the motivation for the gardener in Lady Chatterley's Lover, who becomes the lover of Lady Chatterley. And he was the motivation, if you like, or the inspiration for that. Lawrence did. That's it, really. I mean, I think he's a very interesting character. I mean, it's always about Lawrence and it's always about Frida. And he's in the shadows all the time, kind of thing. And so this is bringing, in a sense, to bring him out of the shadows, out of the, from behind the, how would you call it, the intellectual person of Lawrence, I guess.
He was, of course, Frida's third husband.
Right.
And
her lover while she was still with D.H. Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, he came to America immediately after Lawrence's death, but had obviously had an affair with her while they were living in Italy, and stayed here and for nearly 30 years. Didn't marry Frida until 1950, although he came here in 1930. And there is a story that she finally married him because he was about to be expelled from the U.S. for moral turpitude.
Really?
So the story
goes. What kind of moral turpitude?
Well,
sex and dancing, I think. And it was quite strange because the other Red Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Down in Albuquerque, we had a group of ladies from the towers, and some of them had known him and had known Saki as well, who ran the hotel out there. They were in raucous laughter when certain stuff was mentioned about, especially about Lady Brett
Lady
Smith.
But he was a fascinating character because he worked the ranch. He developed all the buildings there and was, as he says in the play, you know, general manager of the estate, but completely ignored. There has never been anything written about him. You can Google him and it'll give you some information about him.
Yeah, but not a whole lot. I was Googling it
last night. No. And the really interesting thing, without giving too much away about the play, is that by being left the rights of the book, Lady Chatterley's Lover, which of course was worth nothing when he was given it, his family have become multimillionaires through the fact that it's been made into a film, it's been televised, and yet nobody really knows that.
Now, it was the book Lady Chatterley's Lover was worth nothing because it was a banned book.
Yeah, absolutely banned.
And then when it was unbanned, the lover, who the inspiration for the lover in D.H. Lawrence's book becomes a millionaire in his whole family.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a moment in the play when I often think, did Frida leave him the rights almost to say, this is what you caused, you're not going to make anything out of it, but here you are. And not knowing that, of course, because it was the reason for the obscenity trial in the UK, which then meant that publication of books that used rather naughty words could be published, it became the leader of that. And they still, I think we're right in saying, they still, the family still earns the rights because the 80 years has not passed.
And quite right, really, because, I mean, he did so much work up there. He built the ranch up there for them and everything and didn't get the credit for him. And I just find him a remarkable character. I mean, a great character, but and so good and loyal to Frida, I think. And I think there was a great love there as well. You know, he spent almost twice the time with her than she had with Lawrence. And he only knew Lawrence, what, 3 years, wasn't it, before Lawrence died? And he just did a lot of work up at the ranch and stuff. And I'm very fond of him. I enjoy playing him. He's mischievous and that. But And his paintings were better than Lawrence's. We went up and visited, didn't we, when we did research up at Taos. And what was the name of the lady again?
An amazing lady who's now 100 called Jenny Vincent.
Sharp as a razor.
Oh, yeah. And she had known Angelo and Frida and had danced, I think, with Angelo in her time. And she showed us a painting he had done. So when Lawrence was died and Frida had the paintings, she gave him the paintings. And they're really not... well... I mean, some people might like them now, but they're very naive in their actual execution. So,
what's their subject?
Naked people, mostly.
Naked people. Ah. The rape of the Sabine woman in Canaigo. What's the lady in that draws the well proportioned?
Belle Cook.
Yeah, they're a bit like. Do you know Belle Cook's work? No.
They're all large ladies, yeah. And a lot, but
Lawrence, almost cartoonish.
But the reason they were banned was that they actually showed, not only were the people naked, but they also showed pubic hair, which was why they were banned. They were seen to be obscene. So here he was with a banned book.
The whole body is not obscene, but a little bit of hair.
Well, yes, because, I mean, you're talking about the 1920s when there was that sort of post-Victorian fig leaves over certain parts of Greek statues.
Right.
And suddenly Lawrence produces these paintings, which are full, naked, frontal nudity, and the police were called in.
No deceit.
Yeah. Yeah. But the police were called in.
Now, there is art or projections of art incorporated into the play. What are the paintings that we're looking at?
Nine of them, isn't it?
There's actually eight. Because there's the story is based on the night that Angelo sold the paintings to Saki Karavas at the La Fonda Hotel and Taos, where the paintings still hang.
Yeah, he's trying to get the money to go home to Italy because he's got no money. He's absolutely broke. He's living on the ranch on his own, isn't he?
The ranch which he helped build and Frida gave to the University of New Mexico. So he was a sort of non-paying tenant, but with no rights. So the projections are of eight of those nine paintings, all signed with the name Lorenzo and not D.H. Lawrence.
What was that about?
Well, nobody's quite sure. I mean, whether it was that they were painted in Italy, whether he was going through, I am absorbing Italy, or it was a pet name that Frida, we don't really know, but his paintings were signed Lorenzo. So, in fact, having one, you would need to know that Lorenzo was D.H. Lawrence to put any value on
it. I think it's some kind of romantic name he's given himself,
Did he want to divorce his painting life from his writing life?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I mean, I think it was probably how he was known. I mean, for instance, you asked before the interview, is Morris or Maurice? So I assume that in Italy, he wouldn't be known as David, which was his first name, but as Lawrence, which would be Lorenzo in Italian.
Right.
So he may have just been using it because it was the name he was known there, because they were painted in Italy.
And he probably thought it was more romantic than Lawrence anyway. So.
Or maybe he knew they'd be banned and he'd never get caught.
I always have a feeling that there's a passage in the play, and I won't talk about it in case you've got to see it, but where Angelo refers to Frida and a lesson that they've learned, or that she's been speaking about. And I think Angelo knew that lesson, learned it, appreciated it, whatever. Lawrence probably understood it, but didn't know how to enact it, so to speak. I think it was all words and dialogue and dreams and romantic sexual images and stuff like that. But.
Well, of course, when Angelo came into their life, D.H. Lawrence was very ill by then,
right.
Probably dying. And I think that, I'm almost certain he was probably impotent. So for him, the sort of masculinity of Angelo must have appeared attractive as well as a challenge.
The whole play, I mean, it's based on a character about whom not all that much is known. So, I mean, can you talk a little bit about how it came to be, the whole writing process that Stephen Lowe went through and the research? And
it came out of conversations here a year ago, 2 years ago, when we brought
When we did Stephen's play, Empty Bed Blues.
Empty Bed Blues.
Right, which was wonderful.
Yeah, and we took Stephen up to the ranch at Taos. And I think we saw the paintings and we heard the story of how they ended up there.
And I'd done a one-man play before, and Vanessa had always sort of said to me, you should do another one-man play, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, not unless it's a new play, because the one I did before, I was the second to play the role, and played very differently from the first guy, and got rave reviews and stuff like that. But it didn't do me much good in that sense, because somebody else had done it. So it was all coming out of that kind of conversation. And we started discussing Lady Chatterley, blah, 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 blah. Angelo came up, because hardly anybody had known him, nobody talks about him, but he's a very important character. He was there all the time, he built the ranch, he did everything for them. And so that's, in a way, how it came.
Yeah, I think also what's important is that both Stephen and Morris, both we talked a lot about them doing a play together. And then during the Olympics, the run-up to the Olympics in Britain, there was a number of funds that were about the Cultural Olympiad, which was very much part of how the UK, or London, never quite sure I should say the UK, won the Olympics. We managed to get a small grant to do the research behind the character, with Morris researching the character of the man and Stephen researching the story of the man. And we got enough money to take it to a point where we had the outline of the story. We then got an Arts Council grant to take it to a play, but only as far as a reading at Nottingham Lakeside Arts Centre for the D.H. Lawrence Symposium. We then got co-producers involved, which was Assembly, which was the Edinburgh Festival, the Fringe, and Lakeside Arts Centre to take it to a full production. So in a way, the whole process has been a step-by-step process, and we always knew that we wanted to bring it to New Mexico, because obviously that was where Angelo had lived for 30 years.
Right.
So, you know, who knows where it will go next.
Very interesting. So we're talking about the play Just a Gigolo, and talk about the title for a moment.
Well, that was Stephen, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was Stephen. What was it called? What was the title we had before?
Dirty Pictures.
Dirty Pictures.
Of course.
And we thought that might just bring in some of the wrong audience. Just a Gigolo was because Stephen listened to the song Just a Gigolo and felt that A, it was of the period when Angelo would have come here, but also it expressed, as, and we won't give it away because it's a very important part of the story, a lot about the character, or the way that he was seen, rather than who he was, but the way he was seen.
Right.
So that's how the title...
Yeah, I've changed the song slightly with whatever. It was an artist's interpretation of what we did with the swords.
So the play is written kind of with an Italian accent, and you are doing it as an Italian.
It was very difficult, because when he presented it, I looked at it, and it's quite exciting, and because it is just a stream of consciousness. There's hardly any punctuation and stuff, and so it took a while to learn it, and I learned it all. But then I had to unlearn it, because the way we speak, we try to transfer pictures from our head so people understand us through language. So I had to then unlearn it and learn all the pictures, like a comic strip, if you like, so it's in my head. So that I wanted the whole thing to come out almost like beads of sweat on your forehead, as opposed to it's natural, it should work. And that makes it dangerous, exciting to work on every night, because I learn something new every night, and we have no prompter. I'm up in the wire without a safety net, if you like.
Wow.
So, And Vanessa's son, who is our stage director and does all the mechanics and, like, you know, all the sound stuff, he just he can get me out of a mess if I give him a signal, but so far he hasn't. He just throws the papers in the air and says to hell, he'll get out of it one way or another. He's got to get out of it. So it makes it interesting, you know. But also what I'm trying to do is to combine my film technique along with stage technique. So sometimes some of the pauses and things are more important than the lines themselves. So the whole thing, and it was interesting because one of the ladies from Talis, wasn't it? And she was very moved by it and stuff, you know, because she said it was so realistic. But then again, the theatre down there.
In Albuquerque.
Yeah, myself. It's interesting because it's so intimate and they're as close as you and I are at the moment almost. So that was quite interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think also the way that Stephen wrote it, and you've seen the script, it doesn't have any punctuation, but also he wrote it as if an Italian was speaking it.
Yeah, very much so.
So you almost, as you're reading it, when we got the first draft, we were almost speaking to each other with a stilted Italian accent.
Exactly.
But it's his Italian, you know, and he also writes it because it's like a stream of consciousness. And he's been an actor as well, that he's put in his act, you can almost hear him acting it as he's typing it, kind of thing, which didn't make it easy to learn. And people kept saying, how's your Italian accent? I said, well, people think I sound like an ice cream man. And that's exactly how it should be, because ice cream men don't speak perfect English, you know.
But it's also interesting because, of course, as he says in the play, Angelo learned English from D.H. Lawrence, yeah, who had a broad East Midlands accent, which shortens all the vowels, tightens all the vowels. Then he came and he lived in America for 30 years. Who knows what he sounded like?
Right.
You know.
I think he sounds pretty much like the way I am.
I think so.
Well, there we have it. The play is called Just a Gigolo by Stephen Lowe, and it is happening here in Santa Fe this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and on Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. Morris Roeves is the actor, Vanessa Rawlings-Jackson, producer. And for more information, you can call the Santa Fe Playhouse at 505-988-4262 or go to santafeplayhouse.org. And there's also a link to a Vimeo link to a little piece of the play that I will put on my website, santaferadiocafe.org, linking to it from you guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you for giving us the interview. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Bruce Sherwood. He is a retired physicist and educator, and tonight from 6 to 7:30, he will be leading a student discussion called What is Light? What are Radio Waves? At the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science, Science Cafe for Young Thinkers program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Marisha. It's good to be here.
So the question of what is light, first of all, we have to define light, and I think that you physicists define it differently than we regular people who basically think of it as visible light.
We oscillate on that ourselves, we vacillate. So typically, even a physicist will often use the word light to mean the kind that eyes respond to. But as you imply, of course, there is a broader scope. All kinds of electromagnetic radiation, light is just one kind. And it's the kind that our eyes are sensitive to. Infrared light, our skins are sensitive to. You can feel the warmth of a fire. Radio waves, your radio is sensitive to, but your eyes aren't, and so on. And basically, like sound, we don't hear all possible sound frequencies. We can't hear bats at the high end, and we can't hear elephants at the low end. And we can tell the difference between low tones and high tones. Similarly, we can tell the difference between red and blue. And we can't see ultraviolet, and we can't see infrared.
And so one of the achievements, as you were talking about before we went on the air, of science itself is that we have figured out what the heck light is.
Yes, and I'd like to comment that for 100,000 years, humans have been absolutely fascinated by light. And here in New Mexico, we enjoy the privilege of unusual kinds of light, which has drawn lots of visual artists to New Mexico who have reveled in the light that we have. It adds something really important that just 150 years ago, people for the first time figured out what it is. And I think it's not all that general knowledge exactly what light consists of. And I hope to address that in my talk this evening.
Well, why don't you address it now?
Okay, well, I'll try. It's a little hard without visual aids, which I'll use extensively this evening. But many people know from experience or school that electric charged objects like protons and electrons, like charges repel, unlike charges attract. Now, there's a little mystery there. If you've got two protons a little ways away from each other, we observe that they actually repel each other. And a proton and electron some distance away attract each other.
And yet all the protons are mushed together inside of a nucleus.
Inside a nucleus, and there they're bonded to neutrons that combat the electric repulsion. Otherwise, the nucleus would just fall apart. Well, there's a problem. When you've got two things far apart, and you see that they're repelling each other, how do you think about that? How do you think about this action at a distance? It was something that Newton was criticized for when he said massive objects attract each other, and they said, how can they do that? That's crazy. They don't touch each other. In the 1800s, first Michael Faraday and then Maxwell realized that the way to think about it is that a charged particle like a proton makes a field, which is a rather mystical concept in a way, but it's real. The charge makes a field around itself all throughout space, like a spider spinning a web. So the spider spins the web and hopes that later some fly will come in and interact with the web and get caught. Well, a proton makes a field throughout all space, and if another proton happens to come into this space, it will feel that field and be repelled. It doesn't feel the other proton directly. It's indirect through this field that permeates all space.
And so we know that by being in kindergarten and having bar-shaped magnets and the north end of a magnet when you get to the other north end of a magnet, it only repels it when you get to a certain distance away.
That's
but
right.
But you still don't have to touch it.
Because the field, the strength of the field, gets weaker and weaker the farther you are from an object.
And so that's the magnetic part of electromagnetic radiation.
That's right. And there's two kinds of fields. Charges that are just sitting still, like a proton at rest, makes an electric field, but it doesn't make a magnetic field. If it's moving, in addition to the electric field, it also makes a magnetic field. And a spinning proton makes a magnetic field. And electrons in the bar magnet are spinning, and they make a magnetic field. So moving charges make magnetic fields. Stationary charges make electric fields. Moving charges make both electric and magnetic fields. And then there's one other special case. If a charge simply moves at a constant speed in a constant direction, it makes electric and magnetic fields. But if it changes speed or changes direction, or if we say it accelerates or decelerates, then it makes a very special combination of electric fields and magnetic fields that propagate through space, that radiates away from where the thing is. And that very special combination of traveling electric and magnetic fields is sort of like the ripples in a pond if you stir the water. So you stir the proton, you shake the proton or shake the electron, and it leaves off, it irradiates stuff that we call electromagnetic radiation. And if it's of the appropriate frequency, we see it as light. If it's something else, we pick it up with radio, we feel it on the skin, whatever.
Now, when you say stuff, what do you mean?
As soon as it's this two-part thing. You shake an electron, it radiates fields, electric magnetic fields. We detect them mainly through the influence of the electric field, because when electric field comes to that wall that you're sitting beside, coming from the lights up above us here are emitting electromagnetic radiation, which contains electric field. When the electric field comes to the wall, it shakes electrons in the wall. Shaken electrons radiate just as they did in the lamp. And so the reason you can see the wall is because the wall is actually emitting new light as a result of having its electrons shaken.
So my little shirt here is emitting pink shaken electron frequency radiations that your eyes can pick up.
That's right. That's right. And if I were colorblind and I didn't have red receptors, I might not be able to see that pink. But for normal people, they will see your pink shirt.
We're talking to Bruce Sherwood about the question, what is light? So there's the highest and the lowest places on this electromagnetic spectrum. And at the low, what do we have at the low end?
Well, the lowest end would be AM radio is pretty low. It's like 1,000 kilohertz, or that's a million cycles per second. Below AM radio, even lower frequency, would be, there's some very, very low frequency stuff below the AM band, but that's about the lowest we see.
They're basically radio waves.
Yeah, radio waves is about the low end of the electromagnetic spectrum for practical purposes. And the high end is starting with ultraviolet, and then even higher is X-rays, and even higher than that are called gamma rays. These are just names. They're just labels, convenient labels, for referring to regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. Just like red is a convenient label for the lowest frequency of visible light, and blue is
right.
a convenient label.
For a higher frequency. Now, what is there any natural physical limit to the very highest possible or the very lowest possible?
No, there isn't. If I stand here and I take an electron and I shake it back and forth once per second, it's going to emit electromagnetic radiation of one cycle per second.
Right.
And it might be hard to detect because we don't have detectors for such low frequencies, but it would be irradiating.
Right. Now, there's the question of what these different frequencies do when they interact with matter, and particularly with living organisms.
Exactly. So when a certain frequency in the electromagnetic spectrum hits the retina in your eye, if it has the right frequency, the chemicals in the retina experience a shift. Electrons are moved by the electric field in that light in such a way that it gets interpreted as red. And if it's a higher frequency, it gets interpreted as blue. If the frequency is somewhat lower than red, you may feel a warmth on your skin because your skin will feel that.
Right.
So you sit near a fire. So different frequencies can or cannot be perceived and do or do not have effects on material. X-rays, for example, pass through soft tissues, but they're partially blocked by hard tissues like bones, which is what makes X-rays useful for looking inside the body. So you're absolutely right. Different frequencies of light affect materials in different ways.
And at very high frequencies, they can do damage.
Yes. Above you, ultraviolet, for frequencies above ultraviolet, which includes X-rays and gamma rays, is so-called ionizing radiation. The individual photons that we now think of light being composed of, which is an alternative description, those high-energy waves or photons, either description, can actually yank electrons out of atoms or molecules. And that means that in the body, they can do real damage, because once you pull an electron out of an atom, you've now got an ion that's very, very reactive chemically. And so you pull the electron out by coming in with an X-ray or gamma ray, and you make highly reactive chemical substance in your body. And that's why we limit exposures to X-rays and gamma rays as much as possible, and even higher level UV, because it can, in fact, damage the skin and cause skin cancers.
And sunburn.
But below that is so-called non-ionizing radiation. We cannot do that. It can do something if you have high enough power. So, for example, microwave oven has a frequency comparable to TV or cell phones or FM radio, but it's running at 1,000 watts. It's tremendously high power, and it's in a sealed cabinet. And what it does is it can't ionize anything in your food, but it's got so much high power there, it actually heats the food. The food gets hot.
By moving the water molecules around.
By rotating the water molecules. Yes, exactly.
But my understanding of microwave ovens is that, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of frequencies called microwaves, but one specific frequency is very good at turning water.
Yes, for rotating the water molecules if they're in the food. And you know that if the food doesn't have water in it, it doesn't get hot.
Right.
Your So
yeah, if you put
a chunk of glass, a glass cup. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So what are some of the technological applications of understanding how electromagnetic radiation works?
Well, it has allowed engineers over the last 150 years to understand how to design antennas to efficiently send out radio or TV. It has enabled engineers to understand how to design so-called light guides, glass fiber for bringing high-speed broadband into the homes. It has given people a way to think about how to produce electromagnetic radiation and how to detect it usefully. And so it's led to just tremendous array of things that we use, whether it's AM, FM, radio, TV, cell phones, microwave ovens, it just goes on and on and on. Infrared goggles that emit infrared and you, quote, see in the dark by illuminating with infrared that nobody else sees. Yeah, all of that came from understanding what light was.
And the various dangers. I mean, one of the things that you have, particularly in a place like Santa Fe, is people saying, oh, electromagnetic frequencies are very dangerous. Well, of course, everything we see and everything around us is emitting electromagnetic frequencies.
That's correct.
But some of them, and we know that high UV rays and gamma rays and X-rays and stuff are very dangerous. But what about, well, a microwave oven will kill you if you sit inside it and turn it on.
Because you get hot.
Because you get hot and basically you cook.
Yeah.
But what about the other, do we really know even about the other frequencies, the kind of radio to microwave frequencies and what they do to the body with prolonged consistent exposure?
Well, in a way we do, because for over 50 years we've had radio and television. And those frequencies are similar to all the other things that we use, whether it's cell phones, the leakage from microwave ovens or whatever. I notice in my own kitchen that the microwave oven, when it's running at 1,200 watts inside the box. There is a little bit of leakage. It's enough that it can actually interfere with my Wi-Fi connection in my home because they're comparable frequencies. The Wi-Fi signals and cell phone signals are extremely tiny signals, and the amount of leakage from a microwave oven is also very tiny. But they're comparable.
Right.
And so we've been doing a kind of an experiment for over 50 years of people having microwave ovens in their homes. And they do leak a little bit, but the fields are so extremely tiny that they don't do anything. And that seems to be true for cell phones and TV and what have you.
Bruce Sherwood is a retired physicist and physics educator, and he will be speaking tonight on the topic, what is light? What are radio waves? It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe, Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. And everybody is welcome. Some priority is given to young people, but everybody can go. And I guess we've had a lot of both adults and kids going to these events. It's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue tonight at 6 in the evening. And for more information, you can go to the Santa Fe Alliance for Science website. Bruce Sherwood, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.